The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
It's from the Blue Cliff Record Koan Collection. Nan Chuan's It's Like a Dream. A pointer. Cease and desist. Then an iron tree blooms with flowers. Is there anyone? Is there? A clever person loses their profits. Even though they're free in 7 ways up and down and 8 ways across, they cannot avoid having another pierce their nostrils. But tell me, where is the error? To test, I quote this old case for you to see. As the officer Lu Xuan was talking with Nan Chuan, he said, Master of the teachings Zhao said, Heaven, earth, and I have the same root. Myriad things and I are one body. This is quite marvelous. Nan Chuan pointed to a flower in the garden. He called to the officer and said, People these days see this flower as a dream. Poem. Perception and cognition are not separate entities. Mountains and rivers are not seen in a mirror. The frosty skies, moon sets, the night nearly half over. With whom will it cast a shadow cold in the clear pool? Buddhism has a particular relationship with dreams. It understands dreams as an activity of the mind that creates worlds, a world within a particular dream that is very real. People, places, things, emotions, anxieties, joys. And it says that our waking moments are very much like this, a dream. And what does that mean? How can we understand that without thinking that it encourages us to turn away from life? The Buddha said all conditioned things are dukkha, ultimately lead to dissatisfaction, disappointment. That these arise from self-clinging. Clinging, when we cling to objects, it's the self-clinging to the self that's being projected into an object. That all of this is dependent upon our sense perceptions, our windows to the world. And it all rests on a foundation, a fixed foundation of a sense of, the Buddha said, you. Yours, the self. Cease and desist, the pointer says. Then an iron tree blooms with flowers. The mind moves, we see, we hear, we think, we talk, and the self comes into being. Someone is seeing, someone is hearing, someone is thinking, someone is talking. It seems, if we notice it at all, like it must be true. It's not something we decide to have a sense of, ourself. Everybody seems to have the same experience. How could it not be true? The Buddha said it leads to things. I like this, I don't like this. I agree with you, I don't agree with you. I want this, I don't want this. I am this, I am not that. And in a sense, the battleground has been set. And so what we see in practice is that our mind is impulsive, a very good word to describe what we find. It's impulsive. It seems to have its own mind. Our mind seems to have its own mind. You can ask it to quiet down, it won't. You can ask it to let go, maybe. It's impulsive. These are described as habits. We know what habits are. We have habits. They're the things we do over and over that you don't have to think about doing. That's been taken care of. That's how it becomes a habit. And this impulsivity is a habit, a strong one, one of the strongest, of mind. It is not conscious. We don't, not aware of it. It seems to lie below the surface. And this is why Buddhism is an examining tradition. We have to see. We have to actually notice what's happening. Or what has been happening will just keep happening. If we want something to shift, we have to recognize, well, what is the thing we want to shift? And not in some distant, oblique way, but actually, what do we see? And so we practice Zazen to bring our minds into attunement, into its natural, bright clarity, which is a little bit of effort involved over forever, because the habit is very strong. The habit to not see is very strong, keeps coming back. Sometimes it's dullness, sleepiness, numbness. Sometimes it's distraction, a wonderful way to not see. Get distracted with something else. But what if all of that habit, or just some of it, start where we are? What if some of it just shifts a bit, slows down, pauses, stops? What if it's interrupted? What then? Then what do we see when we're not just seeing our mind in its machinations, projecting what it wants or doesn't want onto whatever comes in front of us? What then do we see? How then will we experience things, the many things? What are the things, in fact? Vimalakirti, I'm paraphrasing a bit, but Vimalakirti in the sutra said, delusion within ourselves and others arises from our total involvement, and I would say our often very enthusiastic involvement, in the process of actively misknowing, arising from deep set habit patterns of emotion and thought, which are unreal mental constructions, unreal in the sense that they don't exist anywhere. And they can't arise without our construction. Ultimately, Vimalakirti says, there is no self in this body except for impulsive moments of unintentionally establishing a self. Looking closer, there is no I that can be found to be deluded. So in a sense, that's the great challenge of practice, is to free ourselves of suffering that we realize has no place, has no home, has no independent existence. It's not something that exists somewhere. If it did, we could root it out, put it in a vault somewhere. Lord knows we try to get away from it. We try to get away from other suffering. That doesn't work so well. So what is that showing us? Shantideva said, there's no intention to refute the existence of seeing. So when Vimalakirti says, there is no self in this body, there is no self in this emotion, there is no self in this thought, they only arise out of a construction of the mind, which establishes not just a view, an experience, an emotion, but also a sense of someone who is bringing it all forward. But less that we think that there is nothing at all. Shantideva says, there's no intention to refute the existence of seeing, hearing, or any other sense perception. Buddhism never denies that you are here, I am speaking, you're listening, I hope. Hearing, Buddhism has never refuted that. Shantideva said, what needs to be illuminated is the awareness that grasps. The awareness that grasps at what appears to be something that exists by itself. This is the fundamental cause of suffering. This is what the Buddha was enlightened to. This is why he said all suffering arises from self-clinging. And there is no clinging without a fixed sense of self. And so all the Buddha's practice is to turn towards and examine that very question. What is this self that seems to arise, that clings, that suffers, that is confused, that seeks? And so in this koan, the student of Nanchuan was a very important teacher within our lineage, a Chinese master back in the 8th, 9th century, teacher of Zhao Zhou, who I spoke a little bit about during Sesshin. And so Nanchuan and this student, Lu Xuan, were walking one day, and Lu Xuan is quoting a passage from another teacher and saying, heaven and earth and I have the same root, myriad things and I are one body. Isn't this marvelous? Isn't this marvelous? And the footnote to that says, he's making a living in a ghost cave. A picture of a cake cannot satisfy hunger. Living in a ghost cave is a place, well, it's a place where ghosts live, right? And a ghost is a disembodied being, right? You can't touch them. They can't land. They can't actually function. They can't live. They're just a ghost. What is he pointing at? That he's making a living in a ghost cave. He's quoting this poem, which is speaking a truth. It's a truth that in practice, we practice to realize. Heaven and I and earth have the same root. This morning we chanted Avalokiteshvara. The great Kanon Bodhisattva awakens the mind, enlightens the mind, and realizes all things, all beings, all creation has one essence, one root, one nature. We call that emptiness. It's empty of any separate existence, any separate independent entity, any permanence. But it goes on. She also awakens the heart. And therein, nothing is forsaken. So when the student says, heaven, earth, and I have the same root, myriad things and I are one body, this is so marvelous. The commentary says, the meaning of this is that nature, the overall meaning is that nature all returns to self. Everything returns to the self. Everything returns to this one essence. There's a discourse that says the ultimate person is empty and hollow, without form. Yet none of the myriad things are not their own doing. Empty and yet bringing forth a whole world. Who can understand that myriad things are their own self? It's not so easy because using our windows of the world, we look out and we see a world looking back at us. It seems pretty clear that it's not me. You're not me, you're looking at me. I'm looking at you. How can we all have the same root? And that's, I think, a much better way of expressing it, have the same essence, if we understand essence as being essenceless, rather than saying we're all one, right? Because that tends to imply, like right now, we're one, but you're over there and I'm over here. That we have the same root, the same nature, like waves on the ocean. Each wave has the same nature, ocean, but they're different. It goes on to say, although there are spirits and there are humans, there are the wise and the sage, each is distinct, but all alike have one nature and one essence. That's what we practice to realize. Heaven and earth, the whole world is just one self. When cold, it's cold all the way through. When hot, it's hot throughout heaven and earth. When it exists, all throughout heaven and earth exists. When it doesn't exist, heaven and earth do not exist. When affirmed, all throughout heaven and earth is. When denied, all throughout heaven and earth is not. It said that the Buddha, upon his enlightenment, said, between heaven and earth, I alone am the honored one. Which from an ordinary perspective sounds like a very egotistical statement, right? Who is this guy? How do we understand that from a place of no self to be found? What does it mean to be alone? The Buddha said, when we attach to things as permanent, there will be suffering. We should check it out. Is that true? What do we see? When we attach to things as permanent, there will be afflictions. We can try and be compassionate and be compassionate, but without that wisdom, it's going to get tangled. If we attach to things as being utterly absent, empty, non-existent, then there's the affliction of no affliction at all. There's no compassion. Training is on the way, in the way, is to realize both aspects as one body, having the same root. It's very important. It's an essential part of Buddhist teaching and practice. It's very much what this koan is pointing to. How can we know when we're attaching, right, on this path of non-attachment? Like, that seems like a pretty important question, right? If we're practicing non-attachment, how do we know when we're attaching? There will always be a sense of oneself. Always. If we look, we'll see. We will find that we are grasping at something, we're clinging to something. There's something that we want, there's something we don't want. And with that, if we look a little closer, there will be anxiety. There will be some fear. Another way of looking at it is if we think of the enlightened virtues of an enlightened being, which are all human virtues, patience, generosity, selfless compassion, loving kindness, courage, faith, non-discriminating consciousness, joyful effort, mindfulness. When these are present, there can still be clinging, but there is no harm being done. And when these are present, there will be less clinging. When they're absent, there is definitely clinging, and there is definitely self-present, and there's usually harm. So the teaching says, just look for the smoke and trace it back to the fire. To let go. We chanted this morning to be attached to things as illusion, right? Because if we are attaching to something, there has to be I wanting and clinging to something. There can be no attachment without those conditions. The illusion is that those don't exist in the way they appear to exist. And so this student of Nanchuan's is saying, heaven and earth and I have the same root. All are one body. No differentiation. All is empty of any permanent characteristic, any fixedness. But there's a danger here. The danger is to hold on to that idea of emptiness. In holding on, in trying to preserve, we don't preserve what we want because it's impermanent. We don't gain security because we can't actually keep it. It doesn't increase the good. It doesn't bring it closer. It solidly does not work. It does not do what we want it to do when we grasp. That's a good thing to examine. That's a good thing to watch and observe as we are grasping at something, particularly if it's important to us. What is the effect of that? What is it doing to us? What is it doing to whatever we're attaching to? When we're experiencing aversion to something, wanting to get away from something, which is always uncomfortable, we don't avoid the discomfort. We're uncomfortable. Responding with aversion, we're still uncomfortable. We don't become more distant from that thing. We don't become free. We don't become safe. Aversion itself is painful. And one of the aspects of practice is that's important is in sitting and the mindfulness, which is really being alert to what you're experiencing in this body and mind. You know, when you sit, everybody has a practice, the breath. So we're not sitting and trying to focus specifically on the body unless a teacher assigns that to you as a practice. But we're focusing on the breath. But then in different moments, different aspects of the mind, the body, past, present, and future appear. And we come into contact. We make contact. Non-thinking contact. We don't think about it because that's going to distract us from it. We don't deny it because then we're not in contact. We come into contact without clinging. And then it changes. Everything actually changes. But to realize emptiness or to hold on to the idea of emptiness is dangerous. Right? That's why since the time of the Buddha and beginning with the Buddha, there's been 2,500 years plus of caution and warning and corrective teachings and practices to ensure that we don't misunderstand this fundamental aspect of Buddha's teaching, which is ourselves, which we describe as emptiness, non-abiding, no fixedness, impermanent. Because if we cling to that, if we, in a sense, overrun that, then nothing exists, nothing matters, and it becomes nihilistic. That's why the Buddha made it very clear this is a middle path. On the other hand, if we invest entirely into things as things, they have the power to make me happy, to make me fulfilled, to give me what I want. Then we exaggerate the ability of good things in our life to have good effects on our lives. And so Nanchuan, as the commentary says, Nanchuan's way of answering used the grip of a patchwork monastic to pull out the painful spot for the other and break up his nest. He pointed at a flower in the garden and called to his students, saying, "People these days see this flower as though it were a dream." This is like leading the student to the edge of a 10,000-fathom cliff and giving them a little push, causing their life to be cut off. If you were pushed over on level ground, even till Maitreya Buddha was born in the world, you still would simply be unable to accomplish this cutting off of life. And here, this is very important how, as practitioners, we encounter the language that seems to be denying or negating or condemning in some way life itself. We need to go back and that we're getting caught up in the language and understanding it a different way. So cutting off life doesn't mean turning away from life. It means freeing ourselves from the things that bind us to life. And so he likens Nanchuan to a teacher who brings the student up to the edge of a cliff and just gives them a little push. People these days see this flower as if it were a dream. And when a student is sincere, and his student here is very, he's marveling in this teaching, filled with it, excited by it, intoxicated, right? As the commentary said, a little bit of a nest, a little bit on one side. There's something that's not being seen. And so Nanchuan says, "Look at this flower. Some people see it as if it were a dream." Now, is he saying people see it as though something that exists independent and autonomous and permanent outside of the self? Or is he saying some people see this as a dream non-existent, no reality. So when the student is sincere, when the mind is ripe, a word, a simple word, a phrase, a gesture can bring the student into a wakefulness. Shift. Ordinary moments can happen like that too. Oftentimes, some of the more painful moments in our life, a sudden loss, our lives falling apart, the bottom dropping out, chaos in the world, can shake the rafters, create questions, doubts. What is going on? Does anybody know? How am I in the midst of this? How do I live in the midst of this? How do I understand this? You know, we are sense-making creatures. We want to make sense of our world. Every living being wants to make sense of it. They want to understand the world so they can live in it, navigate it, be free in it. We have human consciousness. We think about things. We create concepts. So we want to understand, why is this happening? How did we get here? And we can think that to death and know everything about how we got here, and yet the problem's still there. It hasn't been resolved. It might not have even been attended to. And so there is, in Buddhist practice, some gaining of understanding. So we can understand, if I have created the causes of my suffering, then I need to know, how am I doing that? That's why the Buddha said, if we don't understand the nature of causation, it's not going to be very likely we're going to be able to do that. But then understanding alone is not enough. I then have to actually start shifting those unreal mental constructions. I have to start experiencing, using my body and mind, everything that I have access to as a human being, but now on the path of enlightenment rather than creating delusion. In a way, it just comes down to that. People these days see this flower as a dream. There is dreaming oneself to sleep, and then more sleep and more dreaming. And there is dreaming oneself awake. If every mental construction is unreal, doesn't exist in and of itself, and we create those constructions, we have thoughts. Those of you who came for the weekend had an idea. I'm going to go check this out. Maybe you had been reading something. Maybe it awakened something within you or aroused interest, resonated in some way, struck a chord. And you imagined something, perhaps. Those are constructions of the mind. Unreal, that doesn't mean that they can't be valuable. It just means that they don't exist by themselves. I am thinking these things. I am giving rise to certain emotions. Are they helpful? Are they skillful? Can I put these to good use? Dreaming oneself awake. And so how do we practice awakening ourselves while we're still asleep or partially asleep? Interesting question. How do you dedicate, have a strong intention to cultivate compassion and be on a path of cultivating compassion when you know that you're still in certain moments creating harm? The Buddha was onto this. And so from the very beginning, he said, okay, we have to be able to recognize and take responsibility for those moments when we do cause harm so they don't accumulate. They don't build up. That's not going to be helpful. And so we practice atonement, taking responsibility. We practice the precepts. We practice examining, causing conditions. We do that together. And so there are practices and aspirations, and we have vows, and we set intentions. And we learn how to find ways to move amidst and intermingle with our own impulsiveness, with other people's impulsiveness, in small, everyday, ordinary ways, and also in a world where it's happening, it seems, everywhere. And so that means, in a very real way, we commit to, rather than turning away, to turning towards the very things that we're trying to free ourselves of. Greed and anger and confusion, fear, hatred, pride, jealousy, doubt. But we turn to them in wakefulness, with a path, with intention, with skillful means, with a meditation practice. You know, I was saying to somebody earlier that as long as there's been Buddhism, there's been samsara, which is basically just human-created suffering, which is the only suffering in town. And I imagine in every generation, the practitioners of their time thought, oh my God, it's never been worse than this. I'm just guessing. And here we are, perhaps thinking the same thing. Maybe some people are thinking, and I know some people are thinking, it's never been better than this. Because that's how it happens. Some people see it as death and destruction, and some people see it as moving towards more freedom or power or wealth or whatever is moving. And so since the time of the Buddha, practitioners have been committed to living in the world and realizing its underlying nature so we don't get so caught, not in things, but in our mind of things, the mind that projects and speculates and creates constructions that aren't actually in accord with what's going on. And opening our hearts, doing that most difficult work of cultivating compassion towards those that we may feel are undeserving. And to do that in a way that doesn't lead to being passive or complacent, but is dynamic. I've been reading a book by Wendell Berry. He lives in a rural town in Kentucky. He's a farmer, poet, writer. And he said, one might think that to consider the involvement of human love in human history, and from that to make some offering of imagination and sympathy, a good contribution, would be almost second nature to modern Americans who have made empathy one of their commonest bywords. But love is an egregiously complicating variable. Love, compassion, is an egregiously complicating variable. It is opposed to uniformity and hard-headed realism. It gums up mechanical thought. It plays the devil with objectivity. It disorders accounting. In other words, you can't turn it into a formula. You can't institutionalize, you can't mechanize it. It's not like that. It makes things more complicated. Does it? Or does it actually make things much, much simpler? Does it actually untangle the complications? Well, then why is it so hard? Because we've created so many complications. If I've been busy tying a knot and tightening it every day, it's just a tied knot, but it is tight. So it would be unrealistic to think that I'm just going to sit down and casually, in a moment or two, untie that knot. I'm going to have to work at it. It seems hard, but living with that knot is much harder. And that's actually a very important part of practice, because we are, you know, our genius at evolving, right? At adapting. We're very adaptable. Right? I mean, think about the regions of the world in which people live and thrive. It's like, you know, who moved to the upper Arctic and thought, let's make this our home? Right? But people live there and thrive there, if other people will let them. We're incredibly adaptable, and that's a genius that we have, but it's also a bit of a burden on our back, because we can adapt to anything. And so we adapt to suffering, our own. We accommodate it. And so when we begin to untangle that, it seems too complicated. But the way to do that through practice is simplify, simplify, simplify. Bring it down to its basic elements. Isn't that what Zazen is? He says, the threat to domestic tranquility is not that people take sides and disagree, but that the sides of a political division will assume the purity and passion of moral absolution or moral allegory, in which the people on each side think of themselves as good and of the people on the other side as evil. The passions on both sides then are reduced to mere anger, fear, and hatred. Everybody's right and everybody's wrong. A society with an absurdly attenuated sense of sin starts talking then of civil war or holy war and trending toward the psychology of the battlefield. I thought, what an appropriate phrase, the psychology of a battlefield. Isn't that our basic MO? Everything's a battle. The war against poverty, the war against ignorance, the war against drugs. So absolute a division forbids actual thought or discourse about moral issues, as it forbids self-knowledge, humor, and forgiveness. When we have such an absolute fixed basis, that doesn't allow for, it doesn't want thought, discourse, to actually engage and examine things at a deeper level. In Buddhism, there is no practice without that. We have to examine things at a deeper level, which means we have to clear that battlefield a bit. He said, it may be that such division is prepared by our convention of two political parties. It may be that actual thought about a problem requires more than two opinions. Imagine that. And then he goes on to talk about how living in his small rural community, where he's coming up against his neighbors every day, he said, for the most part, he doesn't know how people vote. He doesn't ask. He said, we meet. He says, we ask, how are you? How's your family? Did you get enough rain this year? It's a farming community. Somebody tells a joke, we laugh. He said, all of us have had enough engine trouble or been stuck in mud or snow out on the road somewhere, and who was there to help us but one of our neighbors? And we have all participated on one side or both in the ancient ceremony. Many thanks. I really appreciate it. What do I owe you? I may need something someday. Nothing. You don't owe me nothing. Much obliged. The ancient ceremony. Giving and receiving. He says, if two neighbors know that they may seriously disagree, but that either of them, given even a small change of circumstances, may desperately need the other, then maybe we should not keep between ourselves, a sort of prepaid forgiveness. We ought to keep it ready to hand, like a fire extinguisher, in case it might prove useful. Why? Because we need each other. Needing each other, knowing we rely on each other, means we have to allow each other a little space. Well, what happens when one person is causing ruin upon another person's person or property? Buddhism says that has to be dealt with. Cause no harm. Cease from harm. Having no attachment to opinion doesn't mean just letting ourselves or others run amok, but that there's a basis. All beings have one essence. In Buddhism, it's the fundamental basis. It doesn't get any more basic than that. Because that's not the basis of a decision. It's not a moral code. It's not because it would be good. It's not because one day I might need you. It's just the way you are and the way I am. It's not a matter of opinion. You don't even have to want it. And there it is. So in Buddhism, that's why the Buddha said that's the ultimate liberation. Because in a sense, it's not negotiable. It's got no expiration date. It doesn't come in or out of fashion, right? It's never not useful when we realize we all have the same nature. Every wave is nothing but ocean. And we don't know that. And so we run amok. And so there is the practice of putting out fires, helping somebody who's been burned, taking care of each other. Stop the hurting. It's the first pure precept. It's just the thing that makes sense. Whatever's causing the pain, stop it. But how about when you don't have the power to do that? It's big. That's where we have to be creative. There is always practicing within ourselves. Changing your mind. Letting your mind be soft and pliable and spacious and clear and compassionate when others are not. So since the time of the Buddha, in every time of every generation of samsara and its own particular constellation of purges or floods or famines or plagues or fires, Buddhism's had them all. Invasions. The constant for Buddhist practitioners has been practice, the path. For a practitioner, you have a path, you can take refuge, which is not an escape. It's sanity. It's knowing what you want your life to be about. It's knowing what I want my life to be about. And living that life. And that I can do that, and you can do that. And even as the conditions change, you have your mind. And as long as we have hands and arms, we can offer them. And know that all things are impermanent. I think the most important people in human history who have done good have just understood at the deepest level that while, from Buddhist perspective, we are not intrinsically good because there is no intrinsic anything that exists in a permanent state. As human beings, we fundamentally want good for ourselves and others. And delusion is where that most fundamental impulse gets confused, becomes self-centered, becomes fearful, and in its fearfulness becomes arrogant, becomes scared, and in scared becomes reckless. But that have understood that basically at the heart of all that is a goodness. And the Bodhisattva path is to always know that and to not give up on that, which is just pretty much a good way to live a life. Whatever is happening. When there's a lot of poison, what's required is a lot of medicine. And so, thank you for those of you who came here for the weekend. I hope this was helpful to you in whatever way it was. Gives you some things to explore, think about. There's always a seat in this endo here for you if you'd like to return. And I think the most important thing, whatever path we take, is that we realize that while we may seem insignificant, and in certain ways be insignificant in the big picture of things, no one is without influence. We have each had influence on each other throughout this weekend. Have you noticed that? Have you been influenced by anyone during this weekend? If not, let me know. And the question is, what kind of influence are we offering?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.